Mindy Rapport with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Rapport.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Rapport with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 24th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Rapport. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Parag O'Malley. He's the author of The Two-State Delusion. Why the goal of a two-state solution in the Middle East is highly unlikely. And how Israel and Palestine are trapped in two competing narratives that will not allow a solution to that crisis. We'll dive into his new book. It's depressing but important. Also, Harry Reid, he backs the deal with Iran, and we're looking close to a lock here on this vital deal in the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives. And Donald Trump, now he's backing progressive taxes.
Oh, Donald Trump.
And he's entertaining and he's great, but he really is the embodiment of a really disturbing right-wing populism, which holds some allure across the globe because of things like backing some potentially sane tax policies. We'll get into that also on the program.
Also on the program, some very interesting things being floated around in recent days about our immigration non-issue.
Driven by Mr. Trump.
Driven by Mr. Trump and various other right-wing racists. Just amazing things that we will be covering in the better half.
That's right. And, of course, we welcome your calls and IMs. Everybody, we will be right back.
Well, I think we should mention up top that the stock market seems to be crashing. Tanking.
Stock market is there's a lot of things to mention. The stock market seems to be tanking. A couple of American kids thwarted a terrorist attack in Paris, which is pretty awesome and pretty amazing. I've been totally off the grid this past weekend.
Same. It was my birthday this past weekend.
Happy birthday, man.
Thank you.
Like, literally, I was off the grid. Like, I didn't have internet access where I was, so I didn't even know. I think I wished you a happy birthday on Friday. But I hope it was fun.
Well, if you did, I wasn't here, so.
Really?
I wasn't here on Friday.
All right. Dude, I'm out of it. Or I thought I did on Thursday. I thought I had wished you happy birthday.
All right, everyone, we have a
electrifying radio. Happy birthday. I hope you had a great time. We'll be right back with Parag O'Malley on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Parag O'Malley. He is the Moakley Chair of Peace and Reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and he is the author of The Two-State Delusion, Israel-Palestine, A Tale of Two Narratives. Professor, I hope I got your name right. Thank you so much for joining us.
You did an excellent job with my name.
Oh,
thank you.
Terrific.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you. So you did an excellent job with my name as well. So thank you so much for joining us. I want to begin. I mean, this book that you've done in Israel-Palestine covers a lot of familiar territory for people who follow this conflict and are familiar with this history, but you take a different lens in a couple of very different and a couple of important ways. One, you're really talking about these two competing narratives that run through the course of the book. I want you, I guess, first to define and explain what is the core Israeli narrative and what is the core Palestinian narrative, and how do they situate themselves in their worlds?
The core is that both believe they are the rightful owners of the land. And the Israeli narrative is that they own it by virtue of divine right, mm-hmm. that they occupied the land 2,000 years ago, were driven out by the Romans in about 77 A.D., and have been a wandering nation, dispersed throughout Europe ever since, and persecuted in every country they inhabited. And were persecuted badly in Spain in the 15th century, and of course in the 19th century were persecuted really badly by the Tsarist Russia. And out of that grew one form of Zionism, and that it's taking refuge in Palestine, the land that was theirs. Of course, Zionism would never have gotten off the ground, and that probably could be qualified, so I won't say that has been absolute, had it not been for the Balfour Declaration in 1917, mm-hmm. when the then Secretary of State in Great Britain wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild saying that the British government looked favorably on the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And that's the, you could say, were the foundations of the emigration to Palestine was placed. On the other hand, the Palestinian narrative is that they simply occupied that land continuously for 1,500 years. Mm-hmm. And when the Jews first began to arrive at the beginning of the turn of the century, the 20th century, they accepted them, mm-hmm. But in time they began to see them as more and more came as colonists. At that time, no one ever thought of the Palestinians in terms of there being a Palestinian people. They were all lumped together with Arabs, mm-hmm. and you know the Jewish position, which appears in the writings of Ben Gurion, was that, well, you know, we can simply get rid of these Palestinians because there's lots of space in Arab lands, and they're Arabs.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, even in the mid-1970s, there was Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir who sure. made the famous statement that there's no such thing as a Palestinian. And, of course, there is such a thing as a Palestinian, and they have their culture and have their traditions that are different from other Arab states, as one Arab state is different from another Arab state. So even though as a result of the wars of 1948 and the establishment of the State of Israel, the Palestinians have not given up their claim to the land. Now, I should modify that. Because the PLO, that's the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which according to the Oslo Accords in 1993 was designated and accepted by Israel as the sole representative of the Palestinian people, agreed to give and accept the existence of Israel on the 78% of the land that it had won post the 1967 Six-Day War, and that there should be a Palestinian state on the remaining 22% of the land.
So, Professor, before we get into the mechanics of this two-state process and how it's sort of become, and I think particularly in this audience, there's a lot of familiarity with maybe the politics and the geographic realities and the so-called facts on the ground that make a two-state impossible, and maybe there's also some recognition of on some people's parts, I think there's certainly a kind of idealistic desire for a binational democracy, which I have sympathy for, but I think that there's a lot of very, very serious practical hurdles towards something like that happening in actuality. And I'd like to get to that later and maybe also draw on some of your experiences in Ireland and South Africa as well. But before we get there, I think along with this narrative structure, you talk about there's some kind of defining psychological states for Israelis and Palestinians that sort of filter both sort of broad general policies and experiences. And with Israel, you talk about security. And it's very interesting because, you know, in the narrative you're building, and one of the things that strikes me as just sort of a fundamental asymmetry of this situation, because this is a fundamentally asymmetrical situation, as your book certainly recognizes, but that even though Israel has obviously been the victim of terrorist attacks from Palestinians, groups like Hamas or Islamic Jihad, and civilians have died, and that is a very real thing, there's also this history of security concerns that goes into the Israeli narrative that just have absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with Palestinians. They entirely predate them. Whereas the Palestinian core grievance or frame, you say, is humiliation. And that is everything from the politics and the realities of occupation and being under siege, and also just the, frankly, I think we could say pretty bluntly, racist and dismissive and sort of dehumanizing attitudes that Palestinians are held under. So, and that is all within the context of the modern reality of what it means to be Palestinian since, say, the 1940s and certainly since the 1960s. So talk about those two narratives and how, and those two states, security versus humiliation, and how that kind of manifests itself in terms of impeding a solution.
Let's begin with the Israelis. I think the best way to understand Israel now is through its reaction to the Iranian nuclear deal. Here there is support across the left and the right for Benjamin Netanyahu's position that this is a bad deal and that it threatens Israel. The basis of their opposition, besides that it misreads a good part of the agreement, is that they simply do not trust the Iranians. Just as Iranians have, Iran has demonized Jews, by the same token, Israel has demonized Iran, and it simply does not believe that it will live up to any of the clauses in the agreement, and that the P5 plus one will be hoodwinked. So there's an absolute lack of trust on their side. And trust is key to this, because if tomorrow morning, miraculously, some form of a two-state solution were put on the table for Israelis to consider, the very same objections would be made, because any two-state solution would have to be carried out in stages. Mm-hmm. And they would say, you simply can't trust. You cannot trust the Palestinians to carry out the provisions of this agreement. Any two-state solution would require the the decommissioning of arms by Hamas. One, Hamas will never decommission its arms. And two, if it did commission its arms, rearming in the Middle East takes about 15 minutes. So they would never trust Hamas in that context of a two-state solution. They will never allow Hamas to be free in the West Bank, because once Hamas is in the West Bank, targeting every population center in Israel becomes immensely simple and immensely difficult to protect against. So absolute lack of trust. As I said, just as with the Iranian deal, it's you cannot trust them. They've hoodwinked you. They've taken you to the cleaner. You don't know what you did. You're bad negotiators. The very same kind of mindset, because they have this mindset of always looking, of not trusting the Palestinians. And why do they say that? They say that because in any poll that has been taken in recent years, until pretty recently, at least you would have a small number, and I must say a diminishing number, of Israelis who believe in a two-state solution. But they believe, if the follow-up question is, what do you think Palestinians would do with a two-state solution? There are about two-thirds of those who are willing to say they would accept a two-state solution believe that it would just be a first step on the part of the Palestinians to reclaim all of Palestine.
So, Professor, finish your thought, and I need to interject about this before we get to the Palestinians. But, sorry, complete your thought.
Sure. Yeah. I can finish with him. You can move on.
Oh no,
the Palestinians.
Before we get to the Palestinians, I think so. What complicates what you just outlined for me, and I have no doubt, and the book is impeccably researched, and you talk to people on the Israeli side, people on the Palestinian side, people in and out of politics, people in and out of power. It's a really fantastic book. But I think the challenge for someone like me, who, by the way, does have some Jewish and Irish heritage, in fact, but, you know, is okay. There is this sense of national trauma in Israel, and there certainly is, you know, certainly anti-Semitism still exists in the world. There certainly are people that would like to engage in terrorism targeting Israel, and there are some people that would like to engage in terrorism targeting Jewish people, period, regardless of a nation state. But the challenge is that, you know, when do we start picking apart the distinction between a national trauma and psychological state of a people and the fact that this is actually a powerful nation state that holds a totally asymmetric advantage over all of its opponents, including Iran? And no matter how nasty Iran's rhetoric might be, the reality is that we were seeing news reports over the weekend of, you know, that this plan to possibly attack Iran that Ehud Barak was pushing, you know, that's and right. Bibi Netanyahu was seriously considering. I mean, that was very close to happening. And if those sites in Iran were attacked, those nuclear sites, that basically would have been the equivalent of like detonating a dirty bomb in Iran. So you have a state and you know, the settlements never stop being constructed at any point. So when do you start to sort of distinguish between, okay, there? Oh, and just also, I think it's important to add to this too, and you speak to this in your book as well. There's some people in the Israeli security establishment, not necessarily in the left or right politically, that will look at this Iran deal and say, hey, this is sensible, this is rational, and this makes sense just from a kind of realist perspective. But it seems like with Bibi and mainstream Israeli politicians, there's no way that we could get to yes. So when do we start saying, is this really about trauma and lack of trust, or is this just sort of becoming a cynical game to justify really untenable and wrongheaded policies? Does that make sense?
Yes, but let me answer that, because it's a very good question. And it's one I asked myself, which is why I went to such lengths in the book to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And another another disease, I won't call it a disease, a condition called continuous stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And a continuous stress disorder is one in which people fear and their trauma exists not because of what happens to them, but because of what may happen to them. And they have difficulty distinguishing between real threats to their being or to their security and imagined threats to their security. So even though, as you say, and Israel is by far, by any means, the most powerful military machine in the Middle East, but people don't use the prism to look at things, we look at them. They use the prism of associated with continuous stress disorder, and they fear things that may not be real. And to us, we would dismiss them as being silly or being just imagined. But imagined fear is as real as real fear, because fear is a feeling.
Right.
And whether it's imagined or real really doesn't matter. So what we can say, so we as outsiders are using a prism to look at the society that the society itself does not use to look at itself. So that's one problem for us in understanding them. The second thing is that over time, Israel has become an increasingly religious society. And young people in longitudinal studies show that young people are becoming increasingly hardline, increasingly pro-Jewish, and increasingly willing to sacrifice part of democracy in order for there to be a Jewish state. And this is young people talking about on trending studies over a period of 12 to 15 years. So the generation that's coming up is tougher than the generation in place. And, you know, while President Obama and other people kind of took Benjamin Netanyahu to task for his last-minute call on Israeli Jews to get to the polls because Palestinian Israelis were going to vote in droves, and said that was kind of racist.
I think so.
The point is,
but
that the Palestinian people, the Israeli people, responded to that call. And this is a problem because many of the best of Israeli scholars, their sociologists, their psychologists, their political scientists, have concluded that indeed Israel is a racist society, an ugly truth they have to face up to. They discriminate at every level against their own citizens, against Palestinian Israelis.
Against black Jews,
not to talk about real
Palestinians. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at every level.
Yes.
And this is you know, and the society itself has so many fissures in it, like the Haredim will form 49% of the population, 41% of the population in 2050. Now, the Haredim do not, and one in every three children in Israel goes to a Haredi school. That means one in three Israeli children at the moment are not learning science, they're not learning mathematics, they're not learning to live in the modern world. They're going to essentially religious schools. And this poses, leaving aside the West Bank and Gaza altogether, and just looking at the state of Israel itself, and the fissures that are running through it, means that in the future it faces huge internal problems. Like again, in the northern part of Israel, in about 10 to 15 years, Palestinian Israelis will be in a majority. So they'll actually be part of the state of Israel, in which Israeli Palestinians would be in a majority. Israeli Palestinians are looking for collective rights. They're looking for the rights of a minority. They're looking for, like any minority, then you could take the case of Northern Ireland. You know, they're a minority of 20%. They'd be a minority of 25% in that 10 years, and they're looking for some power sharing, some say in government that gives them representation to protect their rights. So looking and their economy, the picture, even though we hear about this growing picture of the Israeli economy, and it was a miracle, and it has an enormously innovative high-tech sector.
But lots of inequality, lots of stagnation, yeah.
And when you poll people in Israeli Jews, their greatest fear is not of Hamas, is not of war. Their greatest fear is of falling into poverty. 40%. In every election, the main issues are not, should we have negotiations with the Palestinians over a Palestinian state? Should we try to find a way to end this conflict? Their main concerns are bread and butter issues. The cost of living, the shortage of housing always emerges. You've got to just recall the biggest rally ever in Israeli history in 2011, when over 400,000 people gathered in cities, and Tel Aviv in particular, marching nonviolently, calling on the government for affordable housing. That's 400,000 people. It stunned everybody that so many people would come out on this issue. There's never been a demonstration of that type in its history. So while the rest of the world is saying, or the West is saying, you know, you must get back to the table and you must talk and you must resolve this conflict. The fact of the matter is that once that barrier was built in 2002 after the suicide bombings and the Second Intifada, once that separation barrier was built, not only did it preclude Palestinians coming into Israel proper, but it also psychologically eviscerated Palestinians in the minds of Israelis. Right. They no longer had to think about them. There was no attack within Israel itself. As long as there are no attack within Israel itself, there's not a problem. That's why they didn't begin to revisit this until the war with Hamas in 2014.
So briefly, Professor, so I want to actually get, before we wrap up, I want to get to the Palestinian narrative of humiliation, and then we'll have to circle this to why at this point, and it's sounding very clear why, because I think, again, what's so important about this book and what's really so devastating about this book in many ways is you're kind of you're getting to some of the deeper variables. I think a lot of people understand why a two-state solution is impossible right now because of physical realities, but the psychological barriers might be even more problematic and more enduring. Get to the Palestinian narrative, and then maybe, you mentioned Northern Ireland before, maybe we could look to Northern Ireland and South Africa, other places that you've studied and been closely involved with, and see if there's any sources of parallel or hope that we could find from those examples.
Let me deal with the latter first.
Okay.
Israel takes great umbrage at being called an apartheid state. And I never use the word that they are an apartheid state in the book. But increasingly, it is becoming an apartheid state.
Yeah, that's just a kind of reality. I mean, I don't think that that's a question of people being offended or not. I think that that's just, in many ways, a very just sort of objective description of what's happening there. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's deal with the humiliation, because you've raised that a number of times. The humiliation arises from, in the West Bank, let's begin, from the fact that there are these checkpoints, barriers, roadblocks, bantu stands, if you like, where they live, and they are can be detained at will by the Israeli Defense Forces. The hunger strike recently was about a man who was under what's called euphemistically administrative detention. Mm-hmm. He was arrested for nothing. He was just detained, and you can be detained indefinitely. And the IDF can kind of raid your house. They can do anything they want. And they exist under military law. They are governed by military law. So they never... They're when they have a case against a member of the IDF, it never gets to court. It's never remedied. And there was a book that came out about 2 years ago where a large number of members of the IDF broke the silence, as it's called. That mm-hmm. The book was called Breaking the Silence. And it talked about how these soldiers would say that they would get bored in the West Bank just doing patrols, so they would just arrest a couple of Palestinians just for the sake of doing it, to relieve the boredom. Right. I recount one incident of a very senior Palestinian negotiator who, two of them, I'll just give these stories because it illustrates maybe better than anything. One of them said that it's more my dignity. Regaining my dignity is more important to me than ever having a two-state solution. I want my dignity back as a human being. And the other said, you know, he said, I always recall that some years ago I was stopped at a roadblock by a 19-year-old soldier who told me to get out of the car, kind of put my hands on the roof. And I had my little daughter of about 5 or 6 in the car, and they opened the booth and they went to put under the car and kind of looked inside the car and made me open the various things on the dashboard. And then they said, okay, you can go. And he said, I felt utterly humiliated. And when I got into the car and my daughter said to me, Daddy, what happened? Why did they do that to you? I had no answer for her. I had no answer. And I never felt so humiliated. Now, the important thing, Michael, is that humiliation is an addiction. That might sound strange, but people who become humiliated look for circumstances in which they can be humiliated again in order to vindicate their saying that they are humiliated. Mm-hmm. And there's the literature of this. And it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it is nevertheless true. So going back to the Israeli-Palestinian narrative, you can break it up into two bits. You have the people in the West Bank and the people in the Palestinian Authority, or the party of Mahmoud Abbas, Fatah, would settle for 2 states. And when we talk about negotiations, we talk about negotiating essentially with one part of the Palestinian community. Hamas believes in regaining all of Palestine, all of Israel. Now, it has a completely different agenda, and it's not at the negotiating table. So when we engage in these negotiations with Abbas and the Israelis, and Hamas is left out of the picture.
Is that really entirely
true? It's like negotiations with Northern Ireland without having the IRA at the table. Now,
right.
today right. going on, this in the last months, very reputable reports say
right.
that the Israelis are negotiating via Tony Blair
right.
and Turkey with Hamas,
right.
that they want to reach a separate arrangement with Hamas,
right.
that in return for Israel lifting the siege, and that there would be a ceasefire, or what they call a hudna,
mm-hmm.
for 8 to 10 years,
right.
under which Hamas and Islamic Jihad would no longer fire anything at Israel. And in return, the siege would be lifted. Seaport would be built in Gaza that could export goods to Cyprus. That would be to northern Cyprus.
And maybe do some energy exploration.
Sorry, the Turkish part. Yeah. And if that happens, it suits the Israelis completely, because it is on its way to completely bifurcating Palestine into two states.
Right.
A Gaza state and that's on its own. And then that relieves the demographic problem completely. And we've got to remember, too, that Hamas and Fatah are virtually at civil war with each other. And that one is Islamic and the other is secular Muslim. And that even if you had a Palestinian state, you had the Palestinian West Bank economy.
Right.
Lives on donor support. The Gaza economy is brain dead. So part of the deal, if it ever came about with Israel on a ceasefire, would be that they would help in the reconstruction of Gaza, because at the rate materials are coming into Gaza today, it will take 30 years to restore Gaza to the state it was in 2014. There are still 100,000 people without homes, who live in shelters.
Right.
It's at a snail's pace.
Right.
Virtually nothing has happened.
Right, right. So that's actually, yeah, that raises, there's so many different variables here. But I guess, you know, this conversation could go on for hours, and it will go on, I guess, for years, unfortunately. But if you had to say, and I won't be as saccharine as say, you know, hope, or in some respects, after reading your book and after this conversation, I think that there should just be sort of like a global raid of top-notch psychotherapists and trauma specialists dropped into Israel and Palestine to sort of deal with all of these internal issues you're talking about. But is, in the present circumstance, what, in your mind, if you have any, is the most tangible or possible policy step or any other type of step that you could imagine that would move the ball forward in this in some way?
One would be that the Palestinians, there is the distinction between ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm.
And the occupation of the West Bank must end as a precursor to any kind of solution. And that would entirely change the situation. All those roadblocks would come down. There would be civil rights. There would not be an Israeli military presence. There would be no more roadblocks. They would not live under military control. That would be of huge significance. End the occupation. And after that is done, then one can begin to talk more reasonably. The humiliation factor begins to diminish. One can begin to talk more reasonably what can be done to establish God knows what kind of outcome, because I don't know. You mentioned binationalism. If I were asked, what do I see down the road, I would probably say some kind of binational state.
Mm-hmm.
But the factor that we overlook, Michael, is that there is among segments of both population a deep hatred, not just a little bit of, and that did not exist in Northern Ireland,
right,
but actual hatred.
Hmm.
And this is partly because of the way their children are educated. They are educated really to demonize each other, and to think of Palestinians as the other, and Palestinians are taught to think of Israelis as the other, not as human beings. And, an Israeli general at a conference after Camp David in 2000 said, you know, we will never be able to make peace with the Palestinians until we begin to treat them as human beings. that, in a way, wraps it all up. Mm-hmm. Each side willing to accept each other as human beings. One other step, I would suggest, that worked in Northern Ireland, and it is called parity of esteem. Because in Northern Ireland, you had the nationalist Catholic narrative of history, and you had the unionist Protestant narrative of history, mm-hmm. and they were two entirely different narratives. And by parity of esteem, it meant that I would say, Michael, you're a unionist and a Protestant, and you have your narrative of history. I respect your right to have that narrative, mm-hmm. even though I disagree with every single bit of it. Mm-hmm. I respect your right to have it. And you would say to me, Pádraig, you're a Catholic nationalist. You have your version narrative of history. I respect your right to have that narrative, even though I disagree completely with it. So respect for each other's narratives, an acknowledgement that each respects the other's narrative, even though it is different, would bridge that cleavage between the two, would kind of bridge that kind of intersection where the narratives give rise to conflict.
Well, Pádraig O'Malley, the book is The Two-State Delusion, Israel and Palestine, A Tale of Two Narratives. I really, really appreciate your time today. And
thank you for giving it to me. I appreciate it, too.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Thank you.
It wouldn't be fair to blame this all on Donald Trump. He just happens to be at the right place. And when I'm saying the right place at the right time, I mean for xenophobes and racists and the white power, KKK, Nazis, all those horrible white supremacists. He's at the right place at the right time for them. And he's really giving them TV time that they've never had before. And It's drawing eyes to people who previously we would have just ignored before, but we can't because they're jumping aboard this Donald Trump train and they're taking advantage of their 15 minutes. And one such guy, Jan Mikkelsen, is an Iowa radio host, is out there saying, and you know what? I won't do it justice quoting him. So let's just play the clip right off the bat.
Now here's what would work. And I was asked by an immigration open borders activist a couple of weeks ago how I would get all of the illegals here in the state of Iowa to leave. So you're going to call the police every time you find an illegal, or you're going to round them up and put them in detention centers? Yeah, I said, no, you don't have to do any of that stuff. Well, are you going to invite them to leave the country and leave Iowa? I said, well, sort of. Well, how are you going to do it, Mikkelsen? You think you're so smart. How would you get thousands of illegals to leave Iowa? Well, I said, well, if I wanted to do that, I'd just put up some signs. Well, what would the sign say? Well, I said, well, I'd put them on the end of the highway on western part of the interstate system, and I put them on the eastern side of the state, right there in the interstate system, and in the north on the Minnesota border, and on the south Kansas and Missouri border. And I would just say this: as of this date, whatever we decide to do this, as of this date, 30, maybe this is a totally arbitrary number, 30 to 60 days from now, anyone who is in the state of Iowa that is not here legally and cannot demonstrate their legal status to the satisfaction of the local and state authorities here in the state of Iowa become property of the state of Iowa. So if you are here without our permission and we've given you 2 months to leave, and you're still here, and we find that you're still here after we've given you the deadline to leave, then you become the property of the state of Iowa. And we have a job for you. And we start using compelled labor. The people who are here illegally would therefore be owned by the state and become an asset of the state rather than a liability. And we start inventing jobs for them to do. Well, how would you apply that logic to what Donald Trump is trying to do, to get Mexico pay for the border and for the wall? Same way. We say, hey, we're not going to make Mexico pay for the wall. We're going to invite, though, illegal Mexicans and illegal aliens to build it. If you have come across the border illegally, we give them another 60-day guideline. You need to go home and leave this jurisdiction. If you don't, you become property of the United States. And guess what? You will be building a wall. We will compel your labor. You would belong to these United States. You show up without an invitation, you get to be an asset. You get to be a construction worker. Cool.
Cool. How cool is that, Michael? I mean, maybe we have a different definition of cool, but when I call someone cool or something cool, I don't really have enslaving undocumented immigrants in mind. This guy, Michelson, he later went on to tell a caller that day that you think I'm just pulling your leg about this whole immigration plan of his. I am not. And on top of that all, when he was asked about it by Media Matters, he argued that his plan was constitutionally defensible, legally defensible, morally defensible, biblically defensible, and historically defensible. Now, I'll agree with him that it's probably biblically and historically defensible because, yeah, but legally defensible, morally defensible, and constitutionally defensible? Well, maybe he has an old version of the Constitution. Maybe he has different morals. Maybe he hasn't brushed up on the law of the land here in the United States. But if you think this guy is just some Iowan radio host just spouting nonsense, and who cares? He has hosted the majority of the 2016 Republican presidential field. Rand Paul has been on his show 11 times. In the past, since January 2015. Rand Paul, 11 times on the show. Mike Huckabee, 8 times on the show. Ted Cruz, 5 times. Lindsey Graham, 4 times. Ben Carson, 4 times. Carly Fiorina, 3 times. Marco Rubio, twice. Bobby Jindal, twice. Scott Walker, twice. Rick Santorum, twice. Donald Trump was on the show once before, but outside the 2015 window. He was on the show in October of 2014. So if you want to count Donald Trump as not being on the show since his candidacy, then okay, you could throw him in there with Jeb Bush, Rick Perry, Jim Gilmore, Chris Christie, George Pataki, and John Kasich as having not appeared on this guy's program. So 10 out of the 17 candidates, 11 if you want to count Trump, have appeared on this guy's show. Many, multiple times. And Ted Cruz himself was on the show after this guy made these comments. And it never came up. Why bring that up? Enslaving undocumented immigrants. Cool.
All right, folks, we're going to go straight to the fun half where we will take your calls. I see some of you are already on the line. In fact, would you mind taking me down so I can call in?
No, I
Oh, I can call in? Okay.
You can.
646-257-3920 is the number. But as I say, I already see about three of you are on the line, so we'll get to you in a minute. Join the Majority Report today. You know why joining the Majority Report is awesome and important. Just even like that, I think that that's a conversation that you're probably not going to get in most places on media. Very, very interesting guy, Parag O'Malley. He wrote a really good book many years ago with this guy, Mac Maharaj, who was a African National Congress operative. That's when I first heard of him. I read that book in college. It was a great, fascinating read. Download the app today, majority.fm/app.
You can go to majorityapp.com.
Majorityapp.com. You can do
even
all,
easier.
Even easier. Dude, we make it so easy for you people. You see how hard it is for the Israelis and the Palestinians? And for you, it's just a friggin' walk in the park. All right? So and go then, become a member.
Yeah, justcoffee.coop. That's yes. COOP. Fair trade coffee and chocolates. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% your entire order. Also, if you buy stuff through Amazon, yes, we know all about Amazon, but if you do and have no other way around it, why not take a little bit away from Mr. Bezos?
And give it to another neurotic dictator. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Just a silly Sam joke. Seriously, it makes a difference. Majority Report.
You will notice no difference when you buy through that link, except at the end of the day, when Amazon's going through their finances, they'll go, oh, we got to cut that check to Sam.
Boom. All right, everybody. You know all the other, you know, write us an iTunes review. It's huge help.
Yes, we gotta, please.
That's a big.
Let's at least get like two. And I'm being really generous and easy there with two.
Everything
Can we
is
get
easy.
Two
for...
new iTunes reviews today. Come on. Can right. Sam Cedar come in tomorrow morning, look on the iTunes like he does neurotically every morning?
He does.
And,
help him out.
Yes. And will he see two iTunes reviews at the very least?
Praising Matt and Michael.
Specifically, yes.
Very highly specifically. All right, everybody. We'll see you all in the fun half.